According to recent estimates, about 1 in 3 U.S. adults has high blood pressure. But because there are no symptoms, nearly 1/3 of these people don't know they have it. In fact, many people have high blood pressure for years without knowing it. Uncontrolled high blood pressure can lead to stroke, heart attack, heart failure, or kidney failure. This is why high blood pressure is often called the silent killer. The only way to tell if you have high blood pressure is to have your blood pressure checked. That's a statement by the American Heart Association. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What is hypertension or high blood pressure, and who gets it? What causes high blood pressure, and what are its effects if untreated? What myths are out there about hypertension that can get in the way of proper diagnosis and treatment? Joining us for these and other questions is Dr. Paul Kellerman, professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin Hospital, medical director of Wisconsin Dialysis, and director of the UW Hypertension Clinic.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Is high blood pressure exactly the same as hypertension?
Well, when people think of hypertension, they think of just high blood pressure, but it's really a syndrome that encompasses many organs. So it's not just a problem with the elevated blood pressure, but it can involve thickening of the heart muscle. Independent of the pressure the heart is pumping against, it can involve problems with the kidneys in terms of getting some scarring and such. It can involve hardening of arteries, small vessels that can cause strokes. So it's really kind of a body-wide syndrome.
I was struck when I saw that American Heart Association figure of 1 in 3 U.S. adults. That's awfully high.
Yeah, what's wrong with us?
It's the most common clinical syndrome worldwide and in the United States. There's over 1 billion people worldwide out of the 6+ billion people that have hypertension. In the United States, it's actually a growing problem. In 1990, 27% of the adult population had hypertension. Now it's 31% or almost 1/3 of the adult population. And just like diabetes that's increasing, hypertension is increasing in prevalence, probably related to the obesity epidemic that's occurred in this country.
Is stress at all a factor?
Everybody who comes into my office says, I'm under a lot of stress. And if you think the term hypertension sounds like high stress, high tension, actually it's probably not terribly related from the studies that we have, and is probably not a major exacerbator of hypertension. Hypertension in 95% of patients, it's a genetic disorder. It's very much polygenetic, multiple genes. We don't know what the genes are, but it runs very much in families. So what we call essential hypertension, which is 95% of what the high blood pressure patients have, is a disease that starts in the people's typically when you're in your 30s or 40s with your blood pressure going up a little bit. Mom had high blood pressure. Oh, yeah, my older brother's got high blood pressure. If you're older, then maybe my kids are starting to have high blood pressure. It's very heritable, but it's interesting because it's also very much affected by environment. And we know particularly salt ingestion, sodium ingestion, is very much highly related to development of hypertension and control of hypertension.
I read just recently that the per capita American consumption of salt for the course of a year is 7 pounds, which is twice what's recommended.
7 pounds of salt's a lot. The typical American diet is thought to be 10 to 12 grams of sodium a day, and we recommend for a sodium restriction is typically, or a no added salt diet, it's about 4 grams, and a real restricted diet is 2 grams, which is almost impossible to do in my mind. But everybody who comes into our office, we tell them to take the salt shaker away from the stove and the table. And by doing that, that typically takes you down to about a 4-gram sodium diet or a no added salt diet.
Well, let's talk about the numbers.
Sure.
What they actually mean. If you go into the doctor and you know they put the cuff on your arm and you're given a number with a top and bottom number, give us a breakdown on what it is that's actually being measured.
What's measured is two numbers. The upper one is the systolic blood pressure. The lower number is the diastolic blood pressure. And this is the pressure as the heart pumps and distends the vessels. There's a higher and a lower pressure. What happens is that the doctor or nurse will put a cuff around your arm and will compress the vessel till they can no longer hear anything. And then as they let the pressure down, they will start to hear a sound. That's a systolic pressure. And then when the sound disappears and the vessel is totally open, that's the diastolic pressure. And a normal blood pressure is 120 over 80 or less, as defined by the Joint National Committee, which meets every few years to determine the national policy on hypertension. 140 over 90 is the number that we use as defining true hypertension. And between 120 over 80 and 140 over 90 is considered pre-hypertension, because we know from studies that people in this range have a predisposition to developing hypertension, and that we can actually prevent the development of hypertension by certain means.
Is low blood pressure ever a problem?
Typically, if people are healthy, low blood pressure is not a problem. Lots of people, particularly smaller women, will have pressures that are below 90 over 60. Some people walk around 85 over 60 and feel absolutely fine. That's not a problem. It's a problem if people are ill, but otherwise, no.
Well, and during the course of a day, if you're a person without hypertension, just sort of a normal person at this point in terms of blood pressure, how much of a range do you find?
Our blood pressure always goes up if we have activity. If the blood pressure is dependent on your heart rate, so if your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure will go up a bit, but then your body will compensate for that. So the range, typically, if you have a normal blood pressure, 120 over 80, if you're running up some stairs, your pressure may transiently go up. It's not much. It can go up to 140 over 90. Even if you're running a long distance, it may go high for a while and then go low. But those transient elevations in such a normal people don't matter. What matters to the brain, the heart, and the kidneys is where the blood pressure is the majority of the time. So if 10 minutes a day your blood pressure goes up a little bit, no big deal, as long as most of the time it's down.
I've read about white coat hypertension. Can you talk about that?
White coat hypertension, well, first of all, it's a fact that doctors get higher blood pressures than nurses get when taking a patient's blood pressure, and nurses get higher blood pressures than patients get on themselves.
The readings, you mean?
The readings, higher blood pressures. So there's definitely an effect. So patients get the lowest blood pressures on themselves, and that's why we rely on home blood pressure measurements. White coat hypertension is a syndrome that's not uncommonly found in our clinics. What will happen is a patient will have blood pressures in our clinics that are high, that are 160 over 100. And then at home, they say, well, my blood pressure on my cuff is 120 over 80. The way we diagnose white coat hypertension is to document that the majority of the time their blood pressure is normal. And you can do that with a home blood pressure cuff. And everybody who has hypertension is advised to buy a cuff at the local Walgreens. There's multiple choices. Or what we call ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, where they wear a cuff for 24, 48 hours and we can see multiple measurements are made throughout the day. So white coat hypertension is when we document high blood pressure in the office, but at home they're fine. And the first thing I tell everybody when they buy their cuff is bring it into our office and we'll check it right next to, you know, right after we check with our cuff, because the cuff accuracy, they can be off. And so that's what white coat hypertension is. And white coat hypertension is not a totally benign entity. There are some studies that say that it may be kind of like pre-hypertension. It may be a predisposition to eventually developing hypertension.
Well, I do remember getting some basic readings taken years ago. And I walked, a mile or so to get to the hospital. And it was 14 degrees out. And the readings indicated that I think my blood pressure was 120 over 80, which would be unusually high for me. And my temperature was like 96 degrees because I'd been breathing 14 degree air on my way over there. And nobody seemed to have paid any attention to how did you get here? What were you doing before
here? The way that blood pressure is appropriately taken in the clinic, first of all, the diagnosis is made by a blood pressure of 140 over 90 or higher on three separate occasions. So one blood pressure measurement does not diagnose a person. And it should be done twice during each visit. And it should be done after a person has been sitting at least for 5 minutes.
So there is an advantage to those magazines in the waiting room.
Yes, there is. There is. And I tell people when they take their home pressures, they say, when should I take it? How often? And I say, you know, I usually have people take it three times a week. You know, I say no more than once a day, because some people can get very crazy about it. And I say just take your blood pressure, but take it when you're relaxed. Don't take it when you're rushing in with groceries and, you know, that kind of thing. Take it, doesn't matter what time of day, but just when you're sitting around.
Let's talk about the phrase silent killer that is used sometimes to talk about hypertension, the fact that there aren't sort of noticeable symptoms for many patients.
It really is an asymptomatic disease, and it was the original silent killer disease in the sense that blood pressure really isn't felt typically until you get very high blood pressures. Typically when systolic blood pressures are more than 200 and diastolic blood pressures are more than 120. What we consider moderate to severe hypertension, more than 160 over 100, is typically silent. So what that means is that if a person is not seeing a physician over years and years and years and their blood pressure is running high, they could show up with kidney disease or heart disease or have a stroke. And that truly is what we are concerned about. Now, I think that people are mindful of this and people do get their blood pressure measured and doctor's offices measure it more frequently than we did many years ago.
So there's no connection, for example, between pulse and high blood pressure?
No, not necessarily. I mean, pulse can raise blood pressure, but lots of people walk around with normal blood pressures and a pulse that's mildly elevated. I think your pulse is more dependent on your physical conditioning and weight and such. You know, I will say that people who are, say, active runners that have blood pressures of 100 over 60 often have pulses of 50. You don't usually find those people hypertensive, but occasionally do. So it doesn't really relate that clearly.
And if, a third of the people in the world have this affliction or a sixth of them?
Sixth.
I gather there is no particular body type that would be an indicator of high blood pressure?
Obesity is related to hypertension. There's no question, as I mentioned in the beginning, that people that are overweight have a higher incidence of hypertension, but lots of thin people have hypertension as well. Worldwide, the biggest relation is an association is with the Western diet, so that the high-sodium diets are definitely associated with a much higher incidence of hypertension in societies. Emily and I were talking earlier that societies that traditionally had low sodium diets and then adopted the Western diet have zoomed up in terms of their incidence and prevalence of hypertension.
It's our secret weapon.
Yeah, we've shared this with the world.
Do you find any incidence of hypertension in children? I know you said it typically comes on later, but just the way we see diabetes now moving down into young people and
It's an interesting question. Are we seeing more essential hypertension? I'm not a pediatrician, so it's a little harder for me to answer that. But when children develop hypertension, there's often what we call a secondary cause. Either they have had some problems with reflux of urine when they were a tiny baby that caused some kidney damage, so we look for that. Or we look for other causes because it's not typical for hypertension to occur when somebody's 16 or 18 or 20 years old. When people are less than 30, we start looking for causes that are not this genetic hypertension. That being said, my understanding is that with the obesity epidemic that's occurring in children, where we have 15% of children obese versus 3% 40 years ago, I believe there has been an associated higher prevalence of, if not diagnosed hypertension, but higher blood pressures.
What about the link with high cholesterol and hypertension?
They're independent risk factors, but synergistic risk factors for cardiovascular disease. What I mean by that is that there are major risk factors for cardiovascular disease, and the sexy one is lipids. You see the lady walking down the red carpet, and all of a sudden she drops, and her cholesterol is this. I want to see a commercial that shows the same lady walking down and says her systolic blood pressure is 170, and she drops and gets up. Because it's been shown in the Framingham study for over 50 years now, that hypertension is as important a risk factor for cardiovascular disease as hyperlipidemia and as cigarette smoking and family history. Those are all major risk factors. So they're independent risk factors, but 1 + 1 = 4, because if you have hypertension, that's a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, and if you have hyperlipidemia, that's a risk factor. If you add them together, you have a much, much higher risk than the individual risks alone.
What is the relationship then between obesity and salt at all? Any? I mean,
I think that there is the relationship of obesity and hypertension. I'm not sure it's the salt as much as hypertension shares some pathophysiologic properties with diabetes and obesity. One thing that was shown back about 20 years ago is the one study, very interesting study, took young, newly diagnosed non-obese, non-diabetic hypertensive. So somebody who's 35 years old has new onset hypertension. They're thin. They're otherwise don't have any problems. And they tested their sensitivity to insulin, and they found out that they were insulin resistant, like a diabetic, like a person who is obese. They weren't diabetic, but they had evidence of insulin resistance. So there's something part and parcel of the syndrome that's tied in with insulin resistance in terms of the pathophysiology of it.
And the sodium then plays into it how? The sodium from the salt?
Well, there's also there are abnormalities in the way that sodium is handled by transporters in the cells, all the cells of the body. so that there's abnormalities in the actual sodium content in the cells versus a person who's not hypertensive that may cause a smooth muscle cell in a blood vessel to contract that normally wouldn't contract, for example, and cause hypertension.
Is it somehow related to fluid retention? I mean, if you have something that's really salty.
Well, when you eat salty food, you can retain fluid. But if your kidneys are normally working and doing what they should do, that shouldn't happen. So it's more their hypertension has both what we call volume etiologies, like you're talking about, but a lot of pressor etiologies where the blood vessels contract. So it's probably dual, the salt retention of some for some reason, as well as something that changes in the responsiveness of the blood vessels.
And how is it related to aging? I mean, if this is something that, you know, comes on typically when you're, let's say, 40 or older, how is it related to something that's changing?
Well, as we get older, there's a higher prevalence of hypertension. So to give you an example, 50% of people over the age of 55 have hypertension.
And why? I mean, what is it about the aging process? That's what I'm asking.
I don't think it's really known. I think it may have to – we really believe that one is as we age, our blood vessels do develop disease, okay, and are less reactive. It also may be that as we age, there may be different hormones that are – or cytokines are called chemicals that are put out by the endothelium, the inside of the blood vessels that dilate blood vessels that may not be there when you're older. So that you tend to constrict blood vessels. It's really not known, but it is definitely true that as we get older, there's more and more chance of you having high blood pressure.
Does that number continue to go up, that probability, as you're 70 or 80, or is it likely to peak somewhere in there and drop off?
It's not well studied, but we just know that over the age of 50 to 55 that it gets much more prevalent.
What about the relationship between men and women getting hypertension? Is it about equal?
The data says that it's about equal at this point. There are some diseases that are really different. There are differences between the sexes in terms of prevalence and how it presents. There really isn't much data to support that, that men and women are equally at risk.
Who's at greatest risk for developing hypertension? And if you go in to have your blood pressure checked, what procedures might follow? We'll find out in a moment when we return to University of the Air.
High blood pressure, hypertension, killed 54,707 people in the United States in 2004. That's a statistic given on the American Heart Association website. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Dr. Paul Kellerman, and we're talking about hypertension. You mentioned that older people tend to get hypertension more than younger people. What if you look at different ethnic groups? What do you see statistically?
Well, there is some mixed data about certain ethnic groups. There was some data initially showing that African Americans had higher prevalence of hypertension. That data is a bit mixed, but what's most important regarding the African American population is the predisposition to kidney disease. There is very good data, a trial called the Multiple Risk Factor Intervention Trial in the late 80s that showed that African Americans are four times more likely to develop kidney disease and going on dialysis than non-African-American patients. So there's something about the African-American kidney, if you will, that predisposes to kidney disease. Because of that, the NIH put together a study called the ASK study, and anybody can Google AASK and get the African-American Study of Kidney Disease study. And it ended up changing what drugs we use because there's drugs that we typically would not use because African-American patients are less responsive to them. So there's differences in response to different medications, but that will slow the progression of kidney disease. So that's changed our practice based on the study when we saw this data.
Any idea as to why there would be a higher risk in the African-American community? I mean, has it been controlled in terms of income and diet, for example?
In terms of the issue of incidence of hypertension itself and being and thought to be higher in many studies, it's been very difficult to control for socioeconomic status and in terms of if you talk about stress and other issues that go on. So that's been very difficult to tease out. In terms of the kidney disease, that's being looked at. It's felt that there may be some polygenetic factors. There are people that are looking at some of the West African societies that have very high incidence of hypertension now on the Western diet and trying to tease out what genetic factors may have come over, if you will, during the slave trade 300 years ago.
So if I come into the office three times, I have a blood pressure reading of, 140 over 90. I'm officially hypertensive?
Yeah, it would be called prehypertension right below that, or if you get above that, it would be hypertension.
So then what do you do?
Well, first of all, your doctor is going to want to take more history to make sure you're not part of this 5% or so of patients that have what we call a secondary cause. These causes are some intrinsic kidney disease or narrowing of a kidney artery that will cause the kidney to put out hormones that raise the blood pressure, or some hormones that come out of the adrenal gland that sit on top of the kidneys that can raise blood pressure. There's things that we check for that in terms of history taking, and then the doctor will examine you, and the doctor should be looking at what we call looking for end organ damage. What does that mean? That means they'll be looking at the retina of your eyes through the fundoscopic exam that everybody hates because you see spots afterwards.
Retina? No, what would be the retinal connection?
Oh, well, the retina is the only place that we physicians can directly look at blood vessels without opening you up.
Oh.
Fascinating.
That's why people do that.
That sounds like a really good idea.
Yes.
So you're looking to see if the blood vessels are dilated?
Oh, no. Actually, what happens is with hypertension, there are hypertensive changes in these blood vessels. The arteries get narrower, and they actually look different in terms of the sheen that comes off them. The arteries and veins where they cross, we look to see if the artery is compressing on the vein. And in severe hypertension, we can actually see little hemorrhages and problems on the back of the eyes.
So the first person to diagnose hypertension could be an ophthalmologist.
And that happens. That happens. I've had referrals from ophthalmologists. That's very much true. The other thing we do is look at, in terms of physical exam, the heart and the blood vessels. So not only a good heart exam, but listening to the blood vessels in your neck, the carotid arteries, feeling the pulses in your feet, is an overall assessment of your vascular health is very important, because that'll tell us whether people are getting atherosclerosis, which is an effect of the hypertension.
So if you have someone with hypertension, bad hypertension, and you check their foot, the pulse in their foot, what is it that you would notice that would be different?
The pulses may be diminished or gone if they have underlying vascular disease.
Gone? And
they can be gone, sure. You can have no pulses in your feet that we can't palpate, at least. The pulse, there is flow there, but we can't feel it. And then the other thing is neurologically, we take a look at the patient. Obviously, if somebody's had problems or any history of numbness or tingling or an episode of weakness or anything like that, or there's something that's obviously going on. In terms of assessing the kidneys, we can only really do that with laboratory tests. And so that there's some laboratory tests that your primary care doctor would typically obtain. They would obtain a test called a serum creatinine, which is a blood test that tells us indirectly but very clearly about kidney function, and also a urinalysis to look for protein in the urine, which indicates damage from the hypertension.
And you're doing all of this to rule out that 5%?
Oh, no. Actually, no. Those are other tests. We're doing all this to look at the effect of the hypertension on end organs. That's the brain, the heart, and the kidneys. Okay. In terms of the workup for the secondary causes, at that point, if a doctor is suspicious of that, they will often refer them to a hypertension specialist, and we'll go on with some more sophisticated blood and urine testing and maybe some imaging.
Now, there's hypertension that comes up sometimes during pregnancy, right?
Right. There is. There is a disorder called preeclampsia that women get in the last trimester, typically, where they get swelling and protein in their urine and really high blood pressure, which goes away once people deliver. Sometimes it doesn't go away, and it presages that people really have essential hypertension that's just starting up. Okay, so that is part of our history we take, is have you had hypertension with your pregnancies?
And what about the link between hypertension and stroke then? Because there's some of the people that you see for hypertension, do they find out about it because they've had a stroke? Is it?
That happens. There's people that have had a stroke and I've consulted in the hospital and it turns out they have hypertension. There's two types of strokes. The most of strokes are what we call ischemic strokes, where there's not a little blood clot. There's not enough blood flow to part of the brain. There's also a type of stroke called a hemorrhagic stroke, where people bleed into the brain. Hemorrhagic strokes are much more strongly associated with hypertension. FDR died of a hemorrhagic stroke from uncontrolled and untreated hypertension because there were no medications then to treat him.
And probably was undiagnosed anyway, or did they?
Oh, no. He was actually known. There's a very famous graph of his blood pressure from about 1940 to 45 when
God,
he died.
Can you imagine?
His pressures were extremely high. I mean, I kind of wonder, looking back at that data, whether, you know, when he was at Yalta, whether he was thinking correctly, you know, and whether things would have changed if we had medicines to treat his blood pressure back.
Yeah, of course. Yes, because he died within a month or two of that.
Yeah,
summit at Yalta.
Right. It was and he had a hemorrhagic stroke at 60. We think of FDR dying as elderly. He was only 63.
Do you think having to be confined to a wheelchair played a factor? If you're sedentary, does that increase the risk?
No, I don't think so. I think there were no medicines then. The diuretics and other medicines came in the late 50s and early 60s.
Any other famous people that you know died of hypertension?
No. That's the one I really know about. But anyway, so your doctor, back to your question. So you go in and the doctor says, you know, I think we measured a couple times. I think you have hypertension. And, gee, you know, I think this is essential hypertension from your history. The age was right. And we don't have any other signs or symptoms that would worry.
Some family history.
Family history there and all that. And there's pre-hypertension. Then there's stage one, which is blood pressures between 140 and 90 to about 160 over 100. And then there's stage two, which is above 160 over 100 and above. Now, stage one is kind of mild and stage two is moderate to severe. We will try what we call non-pharmacologic means initially. In other words, try not to use medication, do some other things. And I don't know if we want to address this.
Yeah, let's talk about lifestyle changes.
Lifestyle changes. Okay, good. There are four lifestyle changes that will prevent pre-hypertension from becoming hypertension and will also treat mild hypertension stage one and that are effective. And there's other ones that have been touted, but they like I said, stress reduction really has not panned out as much as we'd like it to. It doesn't seem to matter much. Sodium restriction. And actually, more than sodium restriction, there's a diet called the DASH diet, D-A-S-H. And anybody can Google this and it'll come up with it right in front of you. And the DASH diet actually is a low-sodium diet with a lot of fruits and vegetables, and it actually reduces blood pressure even better than just salt restriction alone. So dietary restrictions can work and will work. Secondly is weight loss. Weight loss independent of its effects on everything else.
Why weight loss? I mean, it seems obvious in a way, but
I think that – well, then I'm just – postulating, but we talked about this insulin resistance business. I think if you're obese, you're more insulin resistant. That may contribute to the hypertension, but that's just postulating. But weight loss works, and it does work. And when we say works, we're saying, you know, people come in and they can be quite obese, and I say, well, you need to lose weight, and they think I'm asking them to go down to their ideal body weight. If you lose 20 pounds, okay, that'll lower your blood pressure typically 3 to 5 millimeters of mercury. And you say, well, that's not much, but that really is. That could mean a significant reduction in cardiovascular disease for yourself. Okay?
So salt reduction, weight loss.
Smoking?
Right. Smoking itself does not reduce hypertension or risk of hypertension, but it's just like lipids. It's an independent major risk factor. So we always assess all those risk factors. So I tell everybody to stop smoking. But the cigarettes themselves actually don't contribute to the hypertension.
What about drinking?
Alcohol moderation is the other one. That does. And it turns out that everybody knows a drink a day is good for you in terms of raising your HDLs, your good
lipids.
That's
what they say.
And it's true. That data is very, very good. But if you drink more in a male, and again, this is more body size issues, in a male more than two drinks per day, and it means two beers, two shots, or two glasses of wine, or more than one drink a day in a woman – that has been shown to raise blood pressure. So alcohol moderation is the third one that we talked about, right? We talked about salt restriction or
weight loss,
alcohol moderation. The last one is aerobic exercise, independent of weight loss. So getting out and doing 30 minutes a day on the treadmill or just walking will lower blood pressure independent of weight loss. So those four things work. So when a patient comes into me and they have a blood pressure of, say, 145 over 96 – which is kind of a – and I'll look at them and I'll say we'll talk about their diet. And if they're above their ideal body weight, we'll talk about weight loss. We'll talk about exercise and we'll talk about alcohol moderation. And then typically in those kind of ranges, we'll say, okay, let's give you 6 months here. Let's take 6 months, 3 to 6 months and see if you can do this and see how your pressures do. And some people come back and do real well and some people don't. And at that point, then we consider medications.
Do any of those exercise machines, aerobic exercise machines, give you a blood pressure reading or would that even be useful while you're exercising?
Typically, no, it won't. They don't and no, it wouldn't really be helpful. They read pulse, as you know. Again, during acute exercise, your pressure may go up initially. And then as you vasodilate, as you get warmer, it may go down. It doesn't really help you that much.
But presumably it wouldn't go up as much once you're more fit or less hypertensive?
It's hard to say exactly how you'd respond. It's presumed that your blood pressure overall through the day would be better if you're exercising. I can't say what would happen to your exercise response on the machine.
And why is exercise, separately from weight loss, why is it thought to help? Is it just that it kind of, I don't know, gives your heart muscle a workout that then makes it handle, I don't know. I guess I don't understand the anatomy of the whole
blood pressure. And I'm going to tell you I don't either. And we don't understand. I love telling my medical students that it's okay to say I don't know. We really don't know, but it does work. And it's been shown in studies to work. But the mechanism behind it, there's lots of postulating about more vasodilation or whatever, but it's stimulating certain cytokines that dilate your blood vessels more, but it's really not known.
And let's say you're a person who has had hypertension. You make these dramatic lifestyle changes, you know, lose the weight, stop the overdrinking and exercise and do all those things, and your blood pressure goes down. Are you always then at greater risk the minute you start putting it back, the weight back on and so on? In other words, is it a very transient kind of thing?
Well, the answer, again, I don't have data my answer would be typically yes. I think what happens is people that are in stage one hypertension will go back to their pre-hypertension. You can delay the onset of hypertension by years by doing these things, but you're still predisposed because of your genetic predisposition, yeah. So, yeah, if you gain it back, it's likely you may end up becoming hypertensive again.
Is hypertension typically a gradual thing, or is there such a thing as sudden onset hypertension?
With essential hypertension, I call it the garden variety genetic hypertension we all have, typically it's a gradual onset thing. People are 35 or 40 and, you know, suddenly start getting some readings. And they often are what we call labile hypertensive. They'll go up to 140 over 95 once, and then the next time it'll be back to 120 over 80 for a few years, and then eventually it gets what we call fixed hypertension. When we see a rapid rise in blood pressure where people are just normal and all of a sudden they suddenly are high and staying high, that makes us look for what we call these secondary causes, these other 5% that have some hormonal issues or kidney artery issues or something else.
Why do you think it is that generally high blood pressure doesn't have that sort of attention given to it? It doesn't seem to be one of these things that you hear talked about all that much. If it's this big a killer.
That's why I'm happy I'm sitting here. I think that it got the kind of attention 25, 30 years ago when we could diagnose it and give it medications, and I think it's been superseded by lipids, and I think it's too bad. I think we need to bring this back. It's just as important, and I'm not compete. We don't want to compete for that's not the idea.
The most deadly disease.
But I think that really you need for cardiovascular disease and kidney disease, all of the disease. We need a multidisciplinary approach in the sense that when somebody comes to me as a nephrologist and a hypertension specialist, have their lipids been checked? Are they smoking? Are they diabetic? My cardiology friends who also do hypertension are doing the same thing. So, you know, it's a multiple risk factors.
How much, to what extent is hypertension? I realize there's a big factor of predisposition, but is there a way to even summarize how much of it is lifestyle induced? Or is it just impossible to untangle lifestyle from other factors?
I would say that the lifestyles contribute to the hypertension, but are not typically the cause of the hypertension. I think that you have genetic predisposition. And then there's environmental factors, these factors we talked about, these non-pharmacologic, non-drug means to treat hypertension. So I think they're contributors, but I think you have it from what you inherit, or at least the strong predisposition to it. But that doesn't mean you can't get rid of it like any predisposition. I mean, people have predispositions to breast cancer because of a strong family history. It doesn't mean you're going to get breast cancer. Or people have predispositions to predisposition to lung cancer.
Or alcoholism.
Right, or alcoholism. But if your dad had lung cancer and was a big smoker and you don't smoke, your risk goes way down. It doesn't become as if you didn't have a family member who didn't have it, but your risk goes way down. The same thing with hypertension. You're not destined to have hypertension. You can start using these non-drug means to treat the hypertension and hopefully avoid it for many years.
Well, we're going to talk about the drugs that are out there to treat hypertension when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
When you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, you're likely to hear an idea that makes a connection to something you've been thinking about. If you need more information, visit our website, wpr.org. There you'll find lots of ways to learn more. wpr.org.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Paul Kellerman, who's telling us about hypertension. And we've talked a little bit about the lifestyle changes you can make if you are hypertensive, things that you can do to ameliorate it, such as lower your salt intake, lower your alcohol intake to a reasonable amount, get aerobic exercise, and there's one more that I'm forgetting. That's
weight
your
loss.
Cue. Weight loss. But let's say I've done all of those things and I'm still hypertensive. Is there a kind of a psychological gap that some people have to jump between saying this is something I can control and this is something that I can't control?
On occasion, I run into patients or people that are medication averse. They don't want to take pills. I don't want to take pills. That's somehow bad, or that's somehow a failure, that we can't do it naturally in some way. And unfortunately, the risk is high for heart attack and stroke over many, many years with hypertension. That kind of thinking sometimes can harm them. I think there's times where we need medications. And in this day and age, we have these medications. So we're not like FDR, who has a hemorrhagic stroke at 63 because there just weren't any medicines available to keep him alive.
So which one would you start with?
That's books that have written about that. But I think that if we start a medication, what we do is it depends on whether they have stage 1 or stage 2 disease. In other words, mild hypertension or moderate to severe, because moderate to severe will often start with two medications at once versus one medication. And the way we choose there is a whole armamentarium of medicines. There's diuretic medications that are thiazide diuretics that are very good at dilating blood vessels. There are a lot of vasodilator medications, medicines called ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers, or big names. And there's direct vasodilators. And there's beta blockers that slow heart rate and dilate blood vessels. We tend to use drugs of one class initially, but we sometimes will start with two. And we use them. They're from different classes. So you're not going to give two diuretics. You may use a diuretic and a beta blocker. You may use a diuretic and a ACE inhibitor. The way I like to choose medications is to kill two birds with one stone. In other words, if a person, for example, has a coexistent medical condition that is also treatable with these medications, then we'll use that medication. Let me give you an example. If somebody has kidney disease, not necessarily from hypertension, but say a person who has diabetes with kidney disease, well, we would want them on this ACE inhibitor medicine because we know that slows the progression of the kidney disease. Well, if they're hypertensive, that's a good drug to use because it'll both treat the hypertension and treat the progression of the kidney disease. Or if somebody just had a heart attack recently, we would want them on a beta blocker medication. Well, gee, if they're hypertensive, let's use that drug to treat the hypertension and help prevent complications after their heart attack. So those decisions are often made, in my mind, to treat coexistent diseases or not to exacerbate coexistent diseases. So if you were a person with really bad lung disease, COPD, or really bad asthma, which can be exacerbated by a beta blocker medication, that would not be a good choice for you.
That's what those histories are for.
So we try and kill two birds with one stone. And I kind of have four rules on how I treat hypertension, and in this order. One is you have to be effective. So we want to get their blood pressure below 140 over 90. And if they have end organ damage, if they have kidney disease, or if they have diabetes is another thing that's important, and cardiac disease, we really want to get them below 130 over 80, because the data, at least in the kidney disease and the diabetes, shows that getting below those levels really, really saves lives. So we want to be effective. And then the second thing is we have to make people free of side effects. And all medications have potential side effects. If you watch the television, they advertise a medication, they list that.
very quickly at the end.
very quickly in a very long list, of which most of them are not common side effects. But common side effects we want to avoid, because if I give you a medication for your hypertension and I give you a side effect that's not very good, then you're just not going to take your medicine. Right?
For sure.
And so each class of medicines have different side effects that we ask patients about. And then that's my second rule is, first rule is be effective. Second rule is make my patients happy, make them free of side effects. The third rule is to make it easy. And in this day and age, there's no reason that anybody should be on medications more than twice per day. And a lot of medications we have that are very long acting are once per day.
And why is that? Just because they're more fine-tuned or because you can do bigger doses for some reason?
Actually, a lot of the pharmacology is more fine-tuned, that they've created extended agents that have extended half-lives so that they really do cover the full 24 hours or at least 12 hours if they're twice a day. And that's really important because it's – and this is all about adherence or compliance is the word that we used to use, where I can tell you that if somebody gives me four penicillin pills to take a day for 10 days, I maybe get in two or three of them. I'm busy, right?
Right.
And there have been – there actually – there's a wonderful study I teach with that shows people that had seizure disorders. This has nothing to do with hypertension, but they had a known seizure disorder and they gave them either one pill, two pill, three pills, or four pills a day. Obviously, there were placebo, but – and it showed that if you had to take four pills a day, you got maybe 35% of patients got it done, and three pills was maybe 50%, and two pills was maybe 70%, and even one pill was 87%, so 13%. And this for seizures. So the point is the less pills you have to take a day, the more likely you're going to take them. That's important. And then the last thing is cost. Not that I don't care about cost, but in our cost-conscious society, particularly in medicine, I think that that should still be number four on the hit parade in the sense that I want to make sure people are treated, that they don't have side effects, that they're taking their medicine. And then we look at costs. And there are some medications that are generic that have come off patent that classes of medicines that we can use that are just as effective. And there are some medications that are still on patent that are quite expensive. So we look at those issues as well.
I was thinking how it's terrible that some people aren't covered by health insurance, because if it's something that could be easily checked, like blood pressure, and easily treated, but you know, some people probably wouldn't show up until they're at the ER in serious trouble.
That's very again the silent killer, and we have people that, especially the uninsured, that don't have medication plans, and it's a travesty. You know, that people have a treatable disease for many years, don't know about it, it doesn't get treated, and end up with on dialysis or end up with heart failure in the hospital. One thing I do want to bring up is the point about how effective these medications are. This is really an important point. We know from multiple very good studies that if we treat people with these agents, that we can reduce the risk of heart attack by about 25% and dying from a heart attack between 16 and 25%. And we can reduce the risk of having a stroke or dying from a stroke by 40%. That's almost half. And that's a critical thing. It's a these are very preventable diseases, the strokes and heart attacks and kidney disease, that we can slow the progression of kidney disease if you have it by control of blood pressure.
You're on these medications for life, though, I gather.
If you have essential hypertension.
One form or another.
Right. If we cannot find a curable cause, that other 5%, yes, very much so, you're on them for life. But if you're taking a pill once a day or a couple pills once a day and you don't have any side effects.
Oh, it's sure. It's
and,
worth it.
Then you're going to live a lot longer.
And let's say you're on one of those medicines and you're suddenly stranded on an island and you don't have access to the medicine for the next day. Is there a kind of rebound effect, or, I mean, does it make you actually more dependent then on the medicine?
There's only one of the medicines that actually has a rebound effect if you stop it. It's a medicine called clonidine, which is used quite a bit. A lot of people are on it. It's a good medicine. It's a reasonably good medication. I don't want anybody to stop it out there if they're on it, particularly this one. You don't want to stop because you can rebound. But most of them, your blood pressure will revert to its natural state if you're off your medicines. So that's the critical point, is a lot of people say, well, gee, my blood pressure is good, so I stopped taking them. No. That's why your blood pressure is good. You need to stay on the medicines. And people run out. Oh, I ran out a week ago. No, you must never run out of your medicines. You must always be on them once you're on them.
We go into these stores occasionally. We see all kinds of whatever you want to call them, herbal, non-medicinal, natural, organic cures. Is there anything to any of that as far as hypertension is concerned?
I'm going to actually, as a nephrologist, I'm going to bring up kidney disease as well. Neither kidney disease or hypertension, there is no herbal remedy that's proven to be helpful. And in kidney disease, it may be harmful because you may not be able to excrete whatever's in these products. So the answer is no. They really don't help. And I'm not anti-naturopathic medicine. That's not my thing at all. But I am evidence-based. I think we have to look at what works and what doesn't. And there's no evidence that these things work. And the other point of going into a vitamin center that has these herbal things or whatever, wherever you go, is that there's no regulation or control over what's in these things. Okay, so
really?
Prescription medications are regulated by the FDA. They're regulated very closely as to what's in them, what the carrier is that carries the medicine, all that. So in these over-the-counter medications, there's really no regulation. And in herbal medications, we don't know what's in them. So if people want to buy them and take them, that's their business. It's your pocketbook, whether you want to spend the money. But I do worry some of the herbal, particularly the Asian medicines, will often be cut with aspirin products. And aspirin products can actually inhibit your blood pressure control. And that's a very important point. If you have high blood pressure, there are medications, other medicines that can interfere with the blood pressure control. One of the most common are what we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, ibuprofen or naproxen. Over-the-counter pain medicines, they're good medicines, but they can interfere with your blood pressure control.
I think I saw something on the news just a few weeks ago about women and anti-inflammatory drugs, the incidence of hypertension, maybe because they take more of them for migraines or something.
I believe that. The other drug I ask people to – over-the-counter medications I ask them to avoid are the cold remedies that are decongestants. Antihistamines are not a problem. But decongestants, the Sudafeds and the ephedrins, actually are not good for you in terms of it'll raise your blood pressure. So we ask people to stay away from those.
They actually – you mean they clash with the medication that you would take for hypertension?
Well, they actually cause vasoconstriction. The blood vessels are constrict and speed up heart rates. So they're not good for your – if you're going to be on them for a week, it's not a good idea if you're a hypertensive person to do that.
So sometimes you hear it recommended, and I've known even physicians who would take an aspirin a day just routinely.
No, that's not an issue. If you're taking a baby aspirin a day, I personally take 162 milligrams as half an aspirin a day. I think all males over 40 should be on that and all women over 50. That's really not it. It's when you're taking larger doses. If you were taking two aspirin four times a day or you were taking ibuprofen 600 milligrams three times a day and you were doing this for day after day after day, that would interfere with your blood pressure control.
And what's the point of taking the aspirin routinely?
Oh, the baby aspirin? I'm sorry. That has been shown to reduce the risk of recurrent heart attack, not primary heart attack, but almost everybody takes them anyway. The baby aspirin greases the wheels, if you will. That a baby aspirin is known to inhibit platelet function, and so you're less likely to form clots in your blood vessels. And it's primarily been shown to reduce the risk of, if somebody's had a heart attack, having a second heart attack. But the advice of American Heart Association is that males over the age of 40 and women that are postmenopausal, typically over the age of 50, should be on a baby aspirin every day.
And some final thoughts about myths, I guess, about hypertension that you want to make sure that nobody continues to hold.
I actually think we covered a lot of them. I think that one myth that I just want to mention is this thing about when I was a resident in the 80s, we were told that your blood pressure, if you're older, 100 plus your age is okay. So if you're 80, 180 systolic. Nah, that's not true.
It sounds high.
But back then, we was kind of acceptable. No, it's not. We have good data that says that if you treat people over the age of – the elderly, which is over the age of 59, I'm getting close, that people have the same reduction of risk of stroke and heart attack and such. The issue about stress, I think that blaming stress in your life as a cause of your hypertension, there's really not data to support it. And what worries me is people will say, oh, it's just I'm stressed. So when I'm less stressed, I'll be better. I don't need to do anything about it. That's what I don't want to see happen. And I think we covered the other things about the naturopathic therapies really not having any evidence at this point.
Does it matter whether it's the top or the bottom number? I mean, is one more important than the other?
That's a good question. There was a time where we thought the diastolic blood pressure, the lower number, mattered than more than 90. And there's very good evidence over the last 20 years that the systolic blood pressure is as or more important than the diastolic. So both numbers matter. Both numbers matter. And there's a large group of elderly that have what we call isolated systolic hypertension. That means that their lower number may be 60 or 70, but their upper number is 170.
Oh, so you get a wider split, in other words.
Right. And there was debate at one time whether to treat that. And there was a thing called the Shep study. It's not one of the
Three Stooges.
That was about it. The systolic hypertension, the elderly study program back in the late 80s, which showed that treatment of systolic hypertension, just isolated systolic hypertension, reduces stroke and heart attack in people. So we take it all very seriously. And I think the one thing is I would just advocate that everybody make sure you know your numbers. That means your lipid numbers. That also means your blood pressure numbers.
Our guest has been Paul Kellerman, and you have filled in a lot of blanks in our knowledge of hypertension, and thanks for doing that. And, of course, the data will continue to come in as to what works and what causes it.
Thank you very much. The one thing I'll say is the good news is that the people's knowledge that they have high blood pressure, their treatment, and the control of blood pressure has continued to improve on all the surveys every 10 years. So we're going the right direction.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.